Well, certain chapters have to be the same. We spoke at great length about the front of Churov, correct? I don't intend to talk about him. Albeit the name Rak was referred to as the city of the Chazon Ish and the Isha Chazon. Isha Chazon refers to the front of Churov, the man of vision. And he truly was the man of vision. The history of Bnei Brak, the untold story of Bnei Brak, except for those who are my class, the untold story is the story of Yitzchok Gershtenkorn, a Hasidic Jew who lives in Warsaw. He is, as I like to joke, an observant Jew. The anti-Semitism in Poland is appalling. A Jew who walks on certain streets is taking his life in his hands. I know, based on something which I'm writing now, for a Jew who would attend university in Poland, legally, a Jew could attend college. That's only de jure. But the fact that it was something that was impossible. The boys could be beaten to death, and the girls also would be beaten by boys. The nuns would be good. Class would begin, the Jews would have to sit on the far left of the classroom, and in the beginning of the class, in university, the professor, the teacher would hand out metal rods and sticks, and they would beat the Jews. That's how their class would begin. They just so much wanted it. There was no way out for Jews. No way out literally and figuratively. There was no way out because to advance, because they couldn't get jobs except for, you know, being peddlers, and they figured with a college. If you had a degree, then you were entitled to state funds. But only they awarded those people with degrees. And if you wish to be a teacher, that was the great plan to make the woman who I'm writing about be the one teacher in Beit Shachin who had a college degree, because then make the whole school, if one teacher can get state funding. The other way is no way out, just simply to leave Poland. Like the Chafetz Chaim had this great idea to leave Poland and go to Israel. So they said to the Chafetz Chaim, and here they're saying, okay, Rav Nissen Alpert, one of the Rebbe, said that when a non-Jew would see a Jew, it was almost Pavlovian. You see a Jew, you spit, you cross yourself, and you say, Jew, go to Palestine. However, if a Jew wanted to do that, it made it impossible. So the Chafetz Chaim wanted to go to get the Zohar prepared from Petach Tikva. They told the Chafetz Chaim, I need a passport. So he went to get a passport, and they said, where's your birth certificate? He said, when I was born, they didn't issue birth certificates to Jews. Chafetz Chaim was in deep into his 80s. In those days, he was already 8 years old. That's an exceedingly old age. The average lifespan was barely 40, and he was 80. Neish Chafetz Chaim, truly what those words were fulfilled. So then they said, okay, bring us 2 witnesses who were present when you were born. People who are the age majority when you were a baby. That means they have to be already deep into their 90s. Even when they say they're going to help, they don't want to help. That's the answer to your question. Why didn't they leave? Because it was all but a possibility. Gershtenkorn sees through this. Gershtenkorn, he had witnessed one event where he was traveling by rail in Poland for a Jew who was taking their life in their hands. He was traveling by rail to Lodz, which was the garment center, traveling by rail, and on the train, all the Jews went into one compartment for their own security. Some Poles saw this and decided to have a little fun. They summoned the soldiers on the train. Soldiers came with their bayonets and began giving haircuts, cutting off the payas, lopping off the beards, cutting off flesh as well. And when the train arrived at the destination, the Jews complained to the police. The police said, what happened? They said, we were just protecting ourselves. They're insulting the soldiers. Jews were placed in jail, and all the money they brought to invest in business they had to use to bribe their way out of jail. That might have been the straw which broke the camel's back for Gershtenkorn. In World War I, unbeknownst to many people, Jews were carted away. Men had to cart like mules, pulling carts with women and children that they were taken to detention centers in Poland in World War I. He saw all this, he said, there's got to be a way out. Now, the way we've been raised, and I know the schools we all went to, just think about Israel. That just was not on the radar of Warsawian Jewry at that time. And he has this idea, and it's simmering and maturing. And Parshas Yisroel, something happens. Why? I don't know, but I suspect something about the Nas V'Nishma, going ahead without buying into it, without really knowing what it's all about. He tells 2 friends in Shabbat Yitro, I want you to come to my house tomorrow, Sunday. I have a secret to share. And everybody always going to tell, I have a secret for you. You think this and that. One thing they never thought of, he says, tell them, let's go to Israel. They come on Sunday, he tells the secret, and he doesn't have to do a big salesman job. They realize, why didn't we think of this? We have to leave here. So it's still a secret. Now 3 people know about it. Comes Purim, Some big-time chacham, some an uncanny Jew with a good nose, somehow sniffs that Gershenkorn has a secret. He claps on the table, he says, we're not reading the Megillah, so Gershenkorn tells all. Gershenkorn had never spoken in public before. Very embarrassed, he looks around the room and he says, people want to go home, they want to eat, they want to make shalach monet. He gets up and he says, we have no future here. We have to go to our home, we have to go to Eretz Yisrael. And they don't greet him as foreign at all. That very night, 37 Jews pull 100 marks out of their pocket, 100 Polish marks, and buy into a plan of going to Eretz Yisrael. By the end of the week, it's 150. He has a nucleus of people who are willing to go to Eretz Yisrael now, and they make a preliminary mission to go buy a plot of land. Gershenkorn, even though he has everyone's trust, he's a young chassid, who is a very honest man. In his shop, when the cash register opens, he has a sign, Shavisi Hashem Negdi Sami. We have it easier in America, where it says in the money, God we trust. Or it was Maroshiv, used to say, Dos the God, the money itself is the deity. But he really believes in everything, and they knew that he was a trustworthy person, because he's a young man. And if I have on my shoulders the responsibility of buying land for everyone else, better if we go through delegation, more senior individuals. Two more elderly gentlemen join him. Very interesting trip. They travel to Alexandria, then take a train to Lod. When they come to Israel, there's three men. Gershenkorn and two other more senior chassidim. One goes to visit relatives and never returns. It's not Gershenkorn, it's another person. Gershenkorn is ambitious. For all intents and purposes, he's on his own. The other person has very narrow, myopic vision. Gershenkorn is intrigued by a plot of land called Ibn Abrak, which he realizes must be the town of the famous Tana, the greatest Tana, Rebbe Kiva. And the landowner, pardon me, the land representative, it's owned by Arabs, says that if you buy this plot of land, which he's honest enough to admit is rather hilly, not the most fertile area, but it's located in a good location because all merchants traveling from Yerushalayim to the Shvela, to the Tel Aviv area, have to go by this area because it's north of Petah Tikva. This area, I'm not going to north of Ramat Gan, and I have to go through this area, Arab marauders rob them, and they hide in the hills of Bnei Brak, of Ibn Abrak. So if you settle this land, you're doing a great service because you'll get rid of the Arabs. So he sees national duty to it also. The problem was, it cost 8 Egyptian pounds a dunum. Dunum was about a quarter of an acre. Or for the whole area, 10,000 British pounds. That's a lot of money. And they had only one-tenth of this. Gershenkorn's partner says, no way, Jose, get in the bus, God's not a chance, Lance. There's just no way that we can afford it. Polish currency is inflated, we have no money. That's trip number one. He goes back to Warsaw, and there's going to be another delegation to go out there. People have no idea what it is. Now, what is Bnei Brak? It is sand dunes that are malaria infested. The little water in the area has never been drained. It's all swamps. And he goes on a second delegation, and when he's there, there are a great Hasidic giants, the Ger Rebbe, the Lover Rebbe, and the Rajuna Rebbe, are in Yerushalayim on a pilgrimage. On their way back to Tel Aviv, he convinces them to come to see the new plot of land. He literally wanted a plot of land that should be not where the four holy cities are. Help me out. Very good. Because these are Hasidim that are gainfully employed. In the four cities, people are named Kolel. They live on Chalukah, money which comes from overseas to support them. They want to be employed because it's better off to be in a mercantile area like Tel Aviv, near Tel Aviv, but not Tel Aviv proper. So he invites these great rebels to come to Bnei Brak, and they're excited. Bnei Brak, the city of Rebbe Kiva. Now you all know to go from Tel Aviv to Bnei Brak takes how long? 5 minutes with traffic. It's nothing, right? So they set out. It's nothing.
Oh, I didn't hear something.
No. Now, it's a very short trip. They set off early in the morning and they arrive late in the afternoon. Because, why? I'm going to tell you. That'll come one day. But how can we manage Israel now? So here's the hope, because as I've told you before, whoever, the sex is so separate, you know. There's a man was walking down the street, and he met a woman, a Gerach Hasidista. 2 blocks later, he met her husband, and said, "No, I just met your wife two blocks ago. He said, I know, we're taking a walk together. So this is the whole idea of these novel ideas. No, we're going to have women, we're going to educate them, we're going to take them to show novel ideas. But he's really, really a maverick, Gershom Klein. They come, and they wisely leave their wives. Now, eventually, on this trip to Israel, on the boat, because the Hasidim, every single night after supper, they go onto the deck, the Brit L'chaim, they dance on the deck, and even the salty captain joins them many nights. And other Jews who are traveling to Israel, with no intention, ever heard of the Red Rock, except for the Seder, decide they're going to come also from the initial settlers of Red Rock. Wisely, they leave their wives in Tel Aviv so they can set up just a shack. The first thing the Hasidim buy when they come to Bnei Brak is?
What
would
they
buy? They're sand dunes. That's right. First thing they buy.
I remember you telling us.
First thing they buy is a donkey.
Yeah.
Because they have to transfer water. There's no water in Bnei Brak. So this is a riot. They have these Hasidim with, you know, never saw a donkey in their lives. Mm-hmm. They've seen it. Now they all have donkeys to transfer water. They finally get the shacks up. Aguda in Warsaw came to the rescue to a great extent. But by the time they get there, they're broke. I'm not going to have time to go into tonight this fabulous fundraising mission he has to America. I find it fascinating how he raised the money. I'll give you a highlight, just a 1 second highlight, but we're ahead of ourselves. They come direct again, finally for Shabbos, they're ready to bring their wives out. This is called
Shabbos. The wives weren't holidays.
Yes. They come to the Bnei Brak. And they were never prepared for what they're... The first Shabbos of Bnei Brak. Now you have to realize this has become overnight a tourist attraction. Hasidim with lying erect like bulletproof stockings, settling this desert sand dunes, and people are coming here because they want to see it. Gershom Klein has an American tourist the first Shabbos there. Gershom Klein is already stricken with malaria because of these mosquito-infested... Swans, yeah, but they are, mosquitoes are infested, they're malaria carrying. So he's having the first Shabbos. Now it's so laborious. There is no work. 1922. I may be off by a year, but it looks 1922. By the way, the vision here is, it goes on the slogan, but I'll tell you, all those who came with him
survived
the Holocaust, right? They thought at first, they didn't know what they
were
getting. No, he just came for a pilgrimage, right? He came on a pilgrimage. He went back. This is really layman. All those people came to Gershom Klein's group. The first Shabbos. So the women, the only way to bathe the children is in a pot with some water. There's no stove, it's just a campfire. And so in the Gershom home, Yitzhak Gershom Klein is lying on bed because he's ill with malaria. He's an American tourist. So Friday evening, finally, after all this work, she finally lights the candles. She can finally rest herself, and she sees the floor is filled with sand. So she opens she wants to sweep the sand out. After she looks at the candles, she opens the door, and this hot, blistering sandstorm blows inside, blows out the candles, puts sand, everywhere, in her hair, in her face, in the food. And Gershom Klein is bending, hears two very oxymoronic sounds. He hears hilarious laughing and mournful crying. He doesn't know what it is. He crawls out of bed, sees his wife, this is just too much for her. It's so pitiful. She's crying. An American thinks it's so hilarious, the whole situation is so pathetic. He's laughing.
She wasn't
going to do it. Right. He thinks funny. It's like the difference between a tourist and an Olah Chadash, right? So it was very difficult. But they're on the map. And then the first thing they have to build is they have to build a road, which is a kind of hilarious scene as well. So Hasidim go to build the first street in Bnei Brak, which is, of course, I'll give you the first name, Rehov. No. Rabbi Kiva. So all the Hasidim go out to build the street. So they're very excited, you're going to build it now. So have they come with their Tehillim, with their Mishnayos. This is beautiful, but this is not the way you build a road. So someone brings them rakes. They start looking at the rake like this. They don't know how to hold the rake. Eventually, they put not much of a road to build the road. The main track of the Bnei Brak is built. And Bnei Brak is on its feet. That's in the summer. That Pesach, they had very illustrious guests. Which I'm only telling you the story because the idea of the open-mindedness of Gershom Klein had illustrious guests as London Chaim Weizmann, the British chemist, later become the first president of Israel. Now, think to yourself, if Elijah would go to Bnei Brak today, how do you think he would be greeted? At best, ignored. At best. So what are you going to do? Think for a second, okay? Put yourself in there, Sambalika. What? Today? I can't tell you what's happening. Yes, it's not. It's a sad commentary. No, I don't want you to miss. I want you to know, Elijah Blum was a very accomplished person. He wasn't a major topic. As always, no cancer is correct. I say, at best, they would ignore him. You know, maybe I should say this, and we'll never smoke some Kent recorder. My point is, it's a small audience. Why do they ask me to speak for Bnei Brak? Because there's been that, it doesn't always work. Sometimes girls go there, but not missing what the city is all about. And they find, as it were, that their hosts are condescending, but not understanding what the mentality is in Bnei Brak. That's the worst thing. You cannot go to the Rambam's Kever and then have any meaning unless you ever learned the Rambam. You can't go to Bnei Brak completely unless you know who the Chazon Ish is, what the plan was, which I haven't come to yet. Then you'll understand all of a sudden, if you understand what they are, there's never a heter to be rude. There's never a heter to think just because I don't agree, not to respect. And these people are really deserving of respect. It is a load per capita in Israel that they're content living lives that are very modest, just so that they can have a life which is absolutely total without compromise. Okay, so who's this guest? It's Chaim Weizmann. So I want you to think for a second. If you were to have this person come, this big wig Zionist come to you, this religious community, how would you greet him? All right, so don't us. Because I find this so indifferent that we want to give it a kniff. So what do they do? The first thing is they have a little girl bring him a bouquet of flowers. Then they bring out the oldest Kohen to give him a Birchat Kohen. And then they have the people with nice voices sing him a rendition of Yishlam Yirchav Rachim Tashuv. And Weizmann is moved to tears. He came with a very famous Jewish rabbi named Warburg, who said he never saw such shame of kinder, such beautiful children, as the yarmulke clad kids of Bnei Brak. And he said he's in 22 countries, but all over the world, he never saw it. Five of them then traveled from Bnei Brak back to America, and he said, if you want to know what real Zion was all about, go look at the Hasidim in Bnei Brak.
How many people were there? That's why you
can read that. It's almost three digits.
Almost what?
Under 100. Okay, now, by that summer, Bnei Brak is broke. Broke, they can't even afford water. It's passed already bankruptcy. Gershon Korn goes to America on a spectacular fundraising mission. It starts off as disastrously as possible. But, here's a lesson always to remember, the darkest part of the night is followed by the dawn. And when everything seemed like it was crashing, he said, the saddest moments of his life, then all of a sudden, people started giving him, you'll go to the Beis HaChaim in Bnei Brak, and you'll see a lineup over there. People don't realize, in the defense, that's Gershon Korn. No one even knows who that is, but now you're all wise. There's Yitzchak Gershon Korn, is in a little fence club area. You wonder about who is this unknown person with the little fence, and now you know he certainly is deserving it. Then you have a row of pretty people, like Rav Dessler, whose 51st year I just was. Rav Dessler was one of the stars of Bnei Brak. Mashkiach Nupanet Yeshiva. And then you have Rashraga Fivel Mendelovich, Rashiva Tervidas, who's going to arrange all the money for Bnei Brak. And then you'll see, you have to be an observant student. Notice this. Kever, on the floor, Rashraga Fivel on the ground. I don't know why that is, but it's clear to me that the man was so humble, that's the way he wanted it. There's no one in this room, even if you're a Brit, who wouldn't be here without Rashraga Fivel. We give, with a lot of justification, Renard Cutler to credit for bringing Torah to America, but his partner hand in hand was Rashraga Fivel, who revived Torah in America. I'm not such a Yankee Doodle, I want to take credit for England and Australia and Europe, but the fact is that the Torah really came from America. Those two. And then that far away is the Chazon Ish and the Stifler, and then on the other side is Rav Shach and the Panovich Rav. And alright, we'll make a quick attempt to get to these Gedolim. We already mentioned Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler was well, we have to start with Chazanish, because he was among... Chazanish, in 1933, the Chazanish comes to Israel, totally, as was his life. Doesn't make any announcements. He's intrigued by the mitzvahs of Eretz Israel. He's the young lion of Vilna, the Gadol Hador, whose name was... Great. Thank you.
Wait, who?
The undisputed Gadol Hador, Chaim Ozer Grzelski. Chaim Ozer was the undisputed Gadol Hador in a time that Chaim was a senior, and all men of significance bowed and deferred to Chaim Ozer. So Chaim Ozer was only too happy to keep the Chazanish from his own mechitza. Chazanish leaves there to solve his life, without any fanfare or pomp. As they arrive in Eretz Yisrael, a small group go to meet them. They drove from the to a rope here, to a rowboat, and then people would pull them onto the beach. So as they go to greet the Chazanish to pull them in, so you have the up-and-coming Gadol Hador. So his first question is, a shy would remain to the laws of Trinus and Isris. He starts asking Halacha. He didn't even land yet. He's still in the boat coming. He has no idea where he's going to stay that night. Where they're going to sleep, where they're going to be. And he asks another question about Trumas and Maestros. Another, that's the Chazanish, only Halacha. So people would send their shilas to Gadol Hador, Chaim Ozer. Chaim Ozer employed the rabbinic expression said about Rebbe, Ari Allah mi Bavel. A lion has ascended from Bavel. Don't send me any more shilas. The Gadol Hador is in your midst, the Chazanish. So thus say the Gadol Hador about the new Gadol Hador is there in Eretz Yisrael. And you know who recognized this? Everyone, including the first Prime Minister. With the beginning of the Nation State of Israel, there is more that has been hammered out regarding the religious population. And Ben-Gurion felt he had to speak to someone from the religious community. Who was he to speak to? There was no dispute whatsoever. To go to a humble home of the neighborhood where the Chazanish lived. Now the Chazanish had come first to Tel Aviv, and Rabbi Stiglitz invited him to come to work in the Vardic Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. Chazanish never wanted to take money from anyone. He wanted to be farness himself only from the sale of his farm. So he said, after Tisha B'Av, I'll be happy to see it. So one Tarlid day, as was always, never an announcement, he and his wife took a bus to Bnei Brak. The bus did not go to Bnei Brak. It went a stop kind of close. And these two then trudged up the hill, and the Tarlid Hamid, he liked what he saw, decided to remain. He rented a home for very little money, without running water. It didn't even have a cell phone. Could you imagine? No microwave. There was no amenities whatsoever. He rented a home. A Jew from Chicago couldn't bear the fact that the Gadol Hador was living in this ramshackle nothing, and he tried to get him to go to a house that he was building. The Chazanish would not take a favor from anyone. He managed to hook him into the Chazanish and tell him, "Oh, I'm building the house for myself. I'd just like you to stay there till I come." He managed to trick the Chazanish. He moved into this house. And from there, all the Jewry went. And that's where the Ben-Gurion went also. And he had that famous meeting. There turned out to be two meetings. At the end of the meeting, Ben-Gurion was impressed by the man. He didn't sway much, because the Chazanish talked about the issues of the day. The Chazanish said, Ben-Gurion asked him, tell me, you know, do you think you're right? You think we're right, at the end of the day, who's going to come out first? That's the way he phrased the question. Chazanish said, this question is discussed in the Gemara. The Gemara says, there Beit Charon, which is a very narrow passageway, if you have two animals coming simultaneously, which animal has the right of way? You have two laden donkeys, two laden camels. Who goes first? I can say that correctly.
One is closer to the destination.
Let's say they come simultaneously.
The stronger.
That sounds very Darwinian. The answer is the one that's laden. One which has more on it has a right of way. So the Chazanish, what? That's what I mean. I said, yes, that's why I correct. I didn't say it's the right way. I'm sorry. One is coming, they come at the same time, but one has, whichever is schlepping more, has a right of way. So the Chazanish that we're laden with salt. That's what we're going to go first. And Ben Gurion said, he was impressed by the answer. Okay. But when Chazanish stands for Ishes Aleph Yud of Rami Shaya Gorelas. And to that humble home of B'nai Brak, everybody came for advice. He really put B'nai Brak on the map. Now, Rabbi Stiglitz, who invited him to come to Yeshiva, told him he wanted him to speak in Rosh Hashanah. He wanted to speak in Rosh Hashanah. Chazon said no. He never spoke in public. He doesn't want to speak. He said it again. Finally, Chazon agreed to speak only in a side room. He went to the side room. He quoted that Mishnah Perek Yalos. I'm trying to remember whose name it was. Giving all the abundant tongues of my knowledge of the island, I will not go to a dwelling place except for place of this Torah. And then he said it again. That was the first of his two major public addresses. All he did was quote the Mishnah and Perek Yalos. I will not dwell in the land unless there's Torah. But the message was clear. The message was that the reason he decided to settle in Mayrock is he wanted to establish a city based on Torah. That's not to have a city with a Jewish flavor, but a city where we're not trying to find kulos, but we're going to be machmer. We want to do Torah law exclusively. That's what Mayrock is supposed to be.
How can he call it Seymour?
He just, that was his personality, was totally, no, but, and so everyone came to him. But it was always on a personal, and we'll see the same thing with his brother-in-law in a moment. The next battle of the Chazon Ish just would not do anything public. That was one of his two public addresses, but he quoted a mission, same thing original. He said the same mission two times, and that was it. They're expecting to hear all kinds of things. He didn't have yeshiva. No. Yes, he did not accept. He decided to go to Mayrock to see the city. He considered this a matter of paramount importance to establish the city, just Torah. Again, not with a Torah flavor. And he told another Gadol once, this is a very good lesson, I was talking about this ever since I heard it, which was many years ago. He told him, you can't fight every battle, because then you lose the war. And he was determined there shouldn't be a movie theater in Bnei Brak. Shouldn't be a movie theater. He put his foot down. To this day, there's no movie theater. I've never seen television antenna in Bnei Brak. He said, because you can argue about everything. That's why, when the Badat puts up signs that this is us, or this is us, or this is us, or the only one that pays attention is my wife. But only pay, so everything's us, so you don't, too many things. He decided you have to pick your battles, what to plan about. The only other time he spoke in public was the water company had the water which was supplied to Bnei Brak had a generator, not a generator, the right term, a pump, which was not the state of the art, and it broke down on Shabbos. So employees came to repair it, and which meant that you were being damaged from the work done by a Jew on Shabbos. So he got up in the main shul of Bnei Brak, the second public address, and said, you may not use the water on Shabbos. If you have a health issue or a pregnant lady, then you must consult the Rav. And that was the second and final public address. Because here's the question, you have to make it clear that you cannot, as far as washing hands on Shabbos, he discussed the Shabbos and Baal, and that was the only other address that was public. And so I've really said the key thing. The key thing is that this is a city that was to be established. The ground rules are Shulchan Aruch. It's not we're going to make a community and try and have a Jewish flavor. The ground rules of this community are Shulchan Aruch. One day the Chazon Ish comes across a sefer, and he's amazed at God at Twitter. Blackwood, brilliance of this. He seems to must be one senior Rosh Yeshiva who writes it. Freshman. He assumes that whoever wrote this must be this brilliant, megatop, chacham, a senior Rosh Yeshiva, and someone tells him, the author of the sefer is a bacher. He says, pipe it for my sister. Pipe it. He sees the way he learns a Rambam, pipe it for my sister. He's learning in the Varna Yeshiva in Ukraine. This is the part of this before Chazon Ish came there. So he summons the bacher to come to Vilna to date his sister. Now, his name is better known as the Cycler, because he came from the town of Horner Cycle. What?
We don't know the Chazon story.
Yes. Yisrael Yaakov Kanievsky. So the cycle would learn a cycle, like he would learn for 20 hours and sleep for 4 hours. That was the cycle that he would learn. So since he had to go on a trip to Vilna, he decided to go two cycles in a row without learning, without sleeping, and he would sleep on the train. Steinberg was a very religious man. He sits down the train and he bolts up like he was hit with a live charged wire. This is a mega chumrah. He fears that the upholstery on the seat of the train has chutneys. Now, I'm not aware of an issue to sit on chutneys. The issue is only to warm your body or, you know, but that, unless you say you get buried within it, then we're quite a home run. You know, it has to be chutneys to the noise. It has to be woven, spun, but all right, I'm not going to argue with this time, but that's for sure. So he spends the whole train ride standing. He comes for the date, and when she sees who her suitor is, she nearly slams the door. Because in Vilna, where she lives, are the big city slickers. The stipler is coming from the Ukraine, from the Vardy Yeshiva. He has a beard, a long coat, muddy boots, and she says he looks more like my uncle than someone's come to court me. Because in Vilna, are the big city slickers with short jackets, clean shaven. They go on the date, and she tells her brother afterward, forget it. He looks like my uncle. Muddy boots, a beard, long coat, and
fell asleep on the
day. Kazanish said, it can't be, this is the wrong one. I still have to learn the Rambam. Quite fix. Now, if he fell asleep, there's got to be an explanation. You have to learn even day, you have to be down the council. There's got to be an explanation. When he heard the reason why he fell asleep, he said, now I know it's perfect for you. And needless to say, they lived happily ever after. The stifler and his reverend. He used to say, the stifler, that we can't go to sleep at night. Irchot, mine claims in here. Irchot, Irchot. We both have our obligations. I have to learn the Torah, and she was involved with some chassadim that she had no time to sleep. She was always taking care of his son and all the monks and girls, and he was busy learning. The stipler took over from the chassadish, the Gadol Hador. It was I've been to many Gadolim before, but before the stipler, I hate to use this analogy, but if you remember from your neighbors, when you saw in your neighbor's house, the Wizard of Oz, I am the wizard and everyone's crumbling and quivering. Before you went for a stipler, you just became so weak-kneed. Your backbone was a jellyfish. You quivered. He was Malach Hashem Tzevavos. He would scare the living daylights out of you. And he couldn't hear. What? 1986. I guess you didn't read my biography of the stipler, but it's rectifiable. Okay. So, the stipler, he really truly had Ruach HaKodesh, and everyone understood that when he would say something, there was never an argument. I'll just give you a few examples. An ambulance was pulled up in front of his house, Rashbam number 10, and the stipler said, you don't want Rashbam number 10, you want Rambam number 10 in Tel Aviv. So what did the ambulance do? When a second participation, they flipped on the siren and went to the Rambam 10 in Tel Aviv, which was the right address. How could he know? He knew. Two Israeli fighter pilots. Now the stipler could not hear. He was hard of hearing because of his experience in the Red Army. He was once on sentry duty, and a bomb went off right next to him, and he wasn't injured, but it pierced his eardrum, so he couldn't hear. And very interesting, by the way, how did he come to Gadol Hador? I know the answer. The answer is from the stipler. The stipler was a sentry in the Red Army. What happened was, in the Vardim Shiva, so it was not viable to stay in Russia with the Bolsheviks, always after them. So they decided to, they went and consulted with the Chafetz Chaim, the girl had run, they're going to flee the border out of Russia into Poland. The problem was that who in the world would want to leave workman's paradise, and was so wonderful, and just in case there's guards all along the border that are armed, make sure you don't leave, and the Poles don't want you to enter. So they had to sneak across the border. So what they did was they hired guides who knew the border patrols well, and there had to be total silence so they could sneak over the border. It was a very sad moment because parents were saying goodbye to children that were 11, 9, 8 years old. And the older Bachman and the Vardik that were 15 years old carried the other ones over their backs for 10, 11, 12 miles through the swamps until they came to the border. This is a sacrifice parents had knowing that they could not raise Jews in Russia, the communist regime. They said it was a final farewell. And the children went over, and the Vardik should have crossed the flight over the border into Poland. So as the group was dividing, as it was a guard and his daughter, and as they got close to the border, the guard motioned, they're going to divide into two groups, half the group with him, half with his daughter. It was late at night. Stipler feared being with the daughter was a shayla of Yichud. They wouldn't go with her, and he was caught and put in jail, and then inducted into the Red Army. Very interesting, his experience in the Red Army, because he would not be machal with Shabbos to Araisa. Like, and how do you avoid that? You have to shoot on Shabbos, so what did he do? Yes. In other words, he would shoot. Upside down. And he can't. concession because he always got a bullseye, shooting upside down. He wouldn't eat food, and then he wrote a letter to his commander. He can't wear the uniform because he was afraid of Chinese. The commander had no idea what to do with this letter, so he gave it to him, the battalion. Had time to know it, he had to give it to the company. Had the company to know it, he sent it to the head of the army. The army knows it, sent it to the chief of staff. Chief of staff to know this letter, he sent it to the head of the public bureau. Had the public bureau know it, he sent it to the head of the chief of secretary general of the Communist Party. He said, just let the Jew wear whatever he wants, and all the way down the chain. So they took the stifler into the clothing warehouse of the army, and, you know, we're talking about freezing, we're talking about temperatures that are so freezing, the mind stops working. And he looked through the uniforms, he afraid of shyness or everything. He finally selected a summer uniform, a cotton shirt and shorts. Because that is... I'm getting to this, one second. So the army came to the conclusion that this guy is really not army material. Doesn't eat the food, shoots upside down, wears shorts. And after a while, he was let out of the army. Now what about the cough nefesh? Here's the answer. How did he come to Dublin Bar? He was on sentry duty one night, and it was Shabbos. There were not enough coats to go around. It's called the great coat. The great coat is very well insulated. The type of vine cannot tell. Or sunset. Okay. Also, what is that? Okay. So what happened was the guard before him. So this guy is busy learning. So he doesn't want to disturb him. So he takes the great coat. There were not the guards would cheer the coat. He put the coat and hung it on a branch of a tree. So the guy wakes up from his learning, he'll live. Now, taking a jacket off a tree is an iser, a shvus, a buxum. So the stifler said, true, I have to wear the coat because it's freezing. Koch nefesh, but I'm not freezing yet, I'll wait 2 minutes. He waits 2 minutes and he said, I'm still not freezing, another 2 minutes. And another 2 minutes. And another 2 minutes, and another 2 minutes. Till his sentry shift was over. He never put on the coat. So how do you come to Dublin Bar? The answer is 2 minutes at a time. I'll learn another 2 minutes. I'll learn another 2 minutes. The quality of supper, not the universe, but I'll learn another 2 minutes, another 2 minutes. That's how you come to Dublin Bar. So the stifler couldn't hear because of his sentry duty. Oh. So people everyone came for a stifler, they'd write out what they want. Ooh, 10 minutes ago. They'd write out a piece of paper what they wanted. And he would read it settled. So two fighter pilots that were newly religious in the Shlomo Galil, 1982 war in Lebanon, had a very dangerous mission to bomb the Tani River. Now the Tani River is a piece of spit. It's no wider than this room. And you can't do that for 38,000 feet, nor for 25,000 feet. You have to go down over the bridge, release the bomb, and get out of there. So it's a very dangerous mission to go so low when a pistol is shot. So they went to the sniper for bracha. And they said their mission is going to be at 7 o'clock in the morning, they want the stifler to daven for them. The stifler said, I will daven for you at 8 o'clock. He said, no, no, no. And they said, because he couldn't hear, start motioning, 7. He said, I will daven at 8. He said, no, 7. He said, at 8. He said, at 8 o'clock. They couldn't get him. And they went all the way to... The next morning when they had the weather report before the mission, they moved up the mission 1 hour. And 8:07 they're back in base. Mission accomplished. He knew. He just knew. I could tell you one after another. But because he couldn't hear, the only vacation he had all year round was on Cholalei, because he wouldn't let the people to write things to him. So he found his only deserved vacation on Cholalei. So I'll tell you, sir, even the stifler wasn't known for his sense of humor, found humorous. The stifler walked into Shul Cholalei, and a fellow saw the stifler, he couldn't resist. Here's the stifler right there, he wants to get a bracha. So he goes up to the front of the Shul, takes off the sign, and he holds it in front of him and says, the same bracha. Okay, my friends, I didn't do justice to the subject, I apologize, but...
Can you come back?
I'm going away now for 2 weeks, I'm sorry. You're going in less than 2 weeks. I shouldn't be here. No, the 12th.
That's in more than 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Enough.